So I want to do one more talk about this third image of seeing the ox, to kind of explore that in a couple of different other ways. So just to share the verse, and I'll share the image again. I see the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here, no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? So we've been working with this image for this last month, and I find that my mind explores different aspects as I sit with it, as I let it kind of ponder. I think that's the benefit of kind of sitting with something for a little longer period. Now tonight, what came to mind was the sense of serendipity, something unexpected that arises that's beneficial for us. So we weren't planning for this to arise, and yet something arose. Now, this happens for many of us, if not all of us, in our meditative practices and other times in our life and in our spiritual practice. You know, we're practicing along, trying to apply the techniques of meditation, of mindfulness, and yet our minds are just this constantly full of thinking, of thought, constant stream of thinking. It's insistent, it's continuous, doesn't actually have any type of break to it. Same every time we focus on our breath, there's one breath we connect, then five times we're lost in our breath, in our thoughts. See, the head's nodding as we reflect on that experience. And what's worse, as we become meditators, we become aware even more of how much we're thinking. Before, we could kind of just blissfully check out and enjoy being lost in thought. But as meditators, we start to actually notice the difference between being connected to our breath, to our bodies, versus being lost in thinking. So it can be quite frustrating when we see this, especially when we want to be on the breath, when we want to practice in a way that allows our steadiness to grow, to deepen, to become more sustained. Or perhaps we're struggling with the hindrances. We find that of craving, aversion, restlessness, sloth, and doubt, they're kind of ganging up on us. That we're trying to practice and the hindrances keep battering us. You find that you're sleepy and you want to be wakeful, so you feel aversion toward that sleepiness. Or maybe your body's hurting and you feel aversion toward that discomfort. And you're filled with restlessness because you can't sit still with it. We start to give ourselves multiple hindrances attack. You know, that aversion is multiplied by sleepiness and by doubt, and it just starts to become very difficult. Sometimes we feel we can't sit for another second, much less the 20 minutes, which is on the timer. Does that relate? Anybody can relate to that experience? Yeah. And then for some reason, we suddenly find ourselves in this kind of sea of calm. Something shifts in us, and suddenly the effort falls away. We don't know why that happened. You know, suddenly one moment I was struggling just to find the breath, and something shifts, unseen, unknown, and there's a stillness, there's a quiet. The body is at ease, the mind is at ease. We find even observing the breath or whatever we might be focusing on becomes less effortless. I mean, less effortful, maybe even more effortless, becomes natural. We feel like I could stay in this meditation all day. It feels very nourishing, very fulfilling. Somehow the struggle that was so prevalent has evaporated. Somehow it's gone away for that period of time. And this effortless quality of this kind of state or this change is really striking, especially in contrast to our normal struggle that we've been tackling. So this is an experience that I certainly had many times as a young meditator and still have today. I might be struggling and then something shifts in my attention. Something shifts really in the way I'm relating. We'll talk more about what that is. And in that place, the mind has this openness. It has this availability. There's a sense of balance that I can meet something even that was really irritating a few moments ago with ease, with balance, with calmness, with equanimity. life tends to have more of a vividness, a sense of aliveness. My senses are really open and awake. And there's also a quality of wonder. So again, these states, you know, it can happen in small ways, in big ways, but they just kind of come out of the blue, unexpected. We don't know what shifted. We don't know how we got there. And so this image in this verse points to that aspect of our practice. I mean, you can point to many different things, but that's one thing I wanted to highlight, how this points to that stillness. And also the wonder, that unexpected ease and effortlessness. To recall the first two images and verses, the first two pictures, you know, first is the seeking the ox. You're just not sure where it is. We talked about how there's often this kind of, we're searching this way and that way, trying to find happiness, trying to find some way of relieving our suffering. And yet nothing seems, we can't find any headway. In the second image, we actually start to see traces of the ox. We start to get a sense of the meditation technique. We start to have glimpses of our that steadiness, that sense of unification of mind and the body. And then finally, seeing the ox itself and how suddenly there's this almost this breath of quietness, this breath of stillness. Instead of the struggle of the first two pictures, the fighting through our minds, our hindrances, fighting through our resistance, there's suddenly this stillness. And the verse opens this way, opening to the world, to nature. And listen, like, where is there a struggle in these first three lines? I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm. The wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. I mean, just hearing those phrases and especially imagining that or this, these beautiful spring days, you know, feeling that breeze, hearing the bird song, you're seeing the brightness of the green. And there's a peace with that. There's an ease. There's an absence of struggle. So this image is pointing back to that kind of unexpectedness that we're struggling, we're looking, and then suddenly there's the ox. Suddenly there is our breath. But not just the breath, but actually a relationship to the breath, filled with ease, filled with non-effort. And these moments or shifts really have this effortless quality. So this kind of shift can happen in small ways, can happen, you know, throughout like the meditation. I noticed there's times I might have been working with the mind, trying to relax the thinking mind, coming back to the moment. And sometimes it just automatically shifts. It kind of ran in a more natural way. You start to notice that more and more. But often when you think back to when you first learned meditation, how when you first had that moment, you're like, wow, this is really neat. I want more of that, right? We'll talk about that a little bit later tonight, that wanting more of that. And these kind of shifts can happen during our daily practice. They can happen in our daily life, you know, especially when we really try to apply our practice to our lives, to those relationships, to those difficulties, to those koans of how do I be in relationship? How do I be a good spouse, a good partner, a good friend, you know, a good son, a good daughter? How do I do that? How to be a good boss, a good employee? How do I actually do that? How do I bring my practice to bear in those times? Sometimes through the struggle, something shifts unexpectedly, and suddenly there's an ease that we have no idea how that arose. It can certainly happen in retreats and also when investigation, inquiry, when we're really looking at it using, I think of inquiry and investigation almost as directed mindfulness, looking at where the cause of suffering might be, understanding the roots of that and seeing how it really reflects back to these deep premises of who I am and what I take myself to be and what I take others to be. So often in these states, if we reflect back, there's kind of four elements that are often at play to create these conditions for this unexpected shift. And the first one is wise effort, concentration, purification, and insight. Those are the four. So let's just touch on those a moment. So wise effort. We could certainly spend a whole talk on this. It's a prominent place in the Eightfold Path. It really connects our intention, our wisdom, a wise view, wise intention, to how we act in the world. That's where that really brings that to bear. Just to summarize it very briefly, it's recognizing and abandoning what's unskillful. Okay, so recognizing when something's arising and I'm relating to it in a way that's unskillful, how do I release that? How do I abandon it? How do I recognize it? And unskillful is defined simply as what leads to more suffering, or increases our suffering, or increases our sense of isolation, our sense of resistance, our reactivity, our dukkha. A wise effort also is recognizing and supporting, maintaining what is skillful, and skillful being what leads to the end of suffering. You know, it really leads to understanding the nature of our suffering, allows that to fall away. So our meditative practice, just, you know, bring it down to the simplicity of our practice, coming back to the breath, cultivating that steadiness of attention, coming back without judgment, without a sense of bias, without a sense of preconception, actually meeting the moment just how it is. These are all applications of wise effort. Like with the sound meditation, you hear a sound and you notice that your mind quickly puts a label on it. Oh, that's a plane. That's a boat or a car. And then there's like, pretty soon after that, there's a sense of liking it or disliking it. Sometimes those happen. One happens more than the first, sooner than the other one. So suddenly we're not relating so much to the sound itself, but more our reactivity to that sound. Oh, I really love that bird song. I want to record it and put it on my phone, for example. Or like, oh, I got to get triple plane windows, or I've got to get ear nose canceling ear things to stop the extra noise. I mean, we start to launch into this whole world, right? So recognizing that, seeing it, and releasing it, that's a process of wise effort. Releasing that and coming back to what's here right now. Learning to connect directly with experience instead of our ideas from it. So wise effort. And so we often are really working with wise effort when things are kind of rough, when things are, it could be just rough, our mind's really distracted, our body's irritated, it's antsy. Learning to practice wise effort provides an environment that starts to lead to these sudden shifts, unexpected, into the middle of this image of seeing the ox. Related to this is concentration or samadhi, this kind of firmness of mind, firmness of attention, a sustained quality of attention, and an unwavering quality. So we often learn this by practicing when our minds are really distracted. Learning to come back again and again really builds that muscle of concentration. And you know, there's qualities of having a light mind, a joyous mind, helps to enhance that concentration. But sometimes the mind feels anything but concentrated, and we're getting lost every other breath, lost in thought. But yet practicing again and again, that starts to build that sustained quality. As long as it's really imbued with wise effort. If we're getting lost in thought and we're coming back with a sense of self-judgment, it's not so wise. It creates a sense of tension in our practice, in our minds. Sometime long ago, I heard this line from a Christian mystic, and I have not been able to find it, but it was something like you could spend a whole hour, you know, and just finding yourself lost in thought and trying to pray, and you just get lost every other moment. But coming back in again and again will be an hour well spent. An hour well spent. And so even though our practice may feel like it's falling apart, not working well, to remember that it is developing that concentration. Purification. the next one. So we don't talk very much about this so much here at Sims, but other styles or traditions do talk about it quite a bit. And there is this sense of the fact that we really are purifying our hearts, our minds through our practice. So again, our wise effort practice. It's almost like that when you take some ore and you smelt it, you heat it beyond its melting temperature, that allows the gold or silver to kind of separate from the rock. So this is the meeting of our meeting the unpacking of our hearts, those things which are unresolved. Often when people face the end of their lives, they go through what's called life review. They start to go through all the things which are unresolved in their life. And often there's this inclination to try to resolve them, to try to have those conversations, to, you know, put things in order. This is part of that purification process. In meditation, it's like this open invitation that you may not realize you're giving yourself to say, let's just, whatever's unresolved, start to rise to the surface. I mean, how many times have you been on a retreat or practicing for a sustained period, and suddenly you start to think about something you haven't thought about for years? It's like, oh, wow, I didn't do that conversation very well. Maybe it was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And you start to see all those kind of sticking points in your heart. And just meeting those with as much clarity and much skill as you can starts to purify. And then finally, insight. This is really the namesake of this style of Buddhist meditation. And we start to see something clearly how it actually is. It's a shift of perspective or perception, really, and more so a shift of the location from where we're seeing. It has an effect of really reordering all our assumptions about self, about others, about the world, but the nature of happiness, the nature of peace, the nature of suffering. You see things in a more clear, direct way. Sometimes insights can be very subtle, gentle. Sometimes they can be very transforming. They can change your whole world in a way that's a little disorienting for a while. A bit like if you thought the world was flat and then you went up into space and actually saw the reality of the globe or the world, your worldview has suddenly changed by that direct seeing, that direct observation. The same thing when we take this under the assumptions of who we are, what we are, assumptions of isolation can also transform us in profound ways. So this relates to another aspect of this picture here. So we've been talking about, again, this shift of kind of falling in unexpectedly this place of quiet, of stillness, of availability. And this other aspect is that something that was so hard to see is suddenly very obvious. You know, this is the line from the verse, here no bull can hide. Here no bull can hide. You know, from this shift, this place, we can suddenly see things very clearly. And yet things that were so confused and hard to see just maybe a few minutes ago or a few days ago suddenly become much clearer, at least for this time of this shift. Thinking back to those first and second pictures where we're searching endlessly through the woods, climbing through the ravines, climbing the mountains, the mountains and ravines going back and forth. The second picture, starting to see those traces of the ox. And sometimes it's clear and sometimes they've disappeared. And then finally in this picture, seeing the ox, where here no bull can hide. Now what this speaks to me around is this no bull can hide is this shift that suddenly we see things very clearly. So the bull is representing the clarity of vision, the clarity of seeing life how it is, seeing our true nature. Now, as human beings, we often do try to figure things out, try to solve the problems in our life, our daily life difficulties, you know, our relationships with our loved ones, with our spouses, with our partners, our children, our parents. And they often hold such, you know, such gripping qualities because they often touch upon some of those much deeper senses of identification. There's deeper wounding, archaic wounding. I start to feel that deep level of the deep pain, really, of identification, of isolation. And, you know, if we're sincere practitioners, we're often trying to find a way through that, trying to understand it. How do I actually talk with that other person? How do I solve this problem? So then on retreat, of course, this sometimes becomes really amplified because we have both the combination of a sustained practice. We're practicing from early on in the day, early in the morning to late at night. We have this container of the retreat where we don't have any responsibilities other than practicing and maybe a little yogi job. And we become much more sensitive. We become much more concentrated. We're able to see much more clearly. And this way, things become a little bit more amplified. And also in investigation, another style of practice, both in daily life, daily practice, retreat practice, is often this burning curiosity, trying to understand something in a deeper way, to see something that I don't see, but I know it's somehow it's true. Like my own practice, one of my early themes, you know, for the first, I don't know, decade or so of practice, was understanding relaxation. Understand what it means to really deeply relax. That was an instruction I took on, both physically relaxing, but more importantly, that mental, emotional relaxation with this moment. Because that was tied to how much resistance I had. So if I was relaxed, I didn't have much resistance. And I understood that the resistance times my experience equaled suffering. And so I had more resistance towards something, it amplified my suffering. If I had less resistance, there's less suffering. So I was really trying to take that on. I worked really hard at relaxing. I remember, you know, sitting at Cloud Mountain, you know, in the retreat hall as a yogi and just, you know, feeling, you know, being a stiff guy, not very flexible, but trying to sit on the floor and just feeling the burning in the legs and the tightness in the legs and just trying to relax with that. And certainly there's lots of kind of interesting states coming from that meeting, that discomfort and relaxing with it. But as I've shared a number of times, I also noticed I was trying to condition a little bit of fear around meditation. I was pushing myself too hard. I heard the bell ring us back to the hall and there was a moment of fear. It's like, okay, I realized I was going the wrong direction. And so then I learned a different way of relaxing, not relaxing through effort, but relaxing through more of surrendering, relaxing through compassion to my own limitations or my own physical body. Remember, there's a different strata almost of what it meant to relax. And each time I would understand a deeper level of it, often this is more on the heart or the mind, I would see how much pain was caused by me not relaxing in a more deeper way. And it just seems so obvious each time there's a deeper understanding. But before that, it was completely unobvious. It was completely hidden. So to use our kind of the Buddhist phrase of delusion, it's like this sense of blindness. I couldn't see through that. It was kind of right on the leading edge of my practice. And so learning deeper and deeper what it really means to relax, even in the midst of activity, even in the midst of something that might be difficult. Same thing with the sense of self. I remember looking and looking for that sense of self. You know, trying to, Rodney Smith, my main teacher, emphasized this investigation. So I'd be really curious. He said I was like a dog with a bone just gnawing on that question. Trying to see where is that sense of self, and all the while it was like myself was really trying to look at itself. So it's kind of a subtle thing that just kept kind of hiding itself and just trying to become more and more subtle more and more relaxed to see more and more clearly. But for a long time, it was like that, that famous painting called Drawing Hands, where by Dutch artists like this M.C. Escher, where one hand's drawing the other one coming out of the paper. And it's a very beautiful image, but it just kind of, where does it start? Where does it end? It's just kind of a continuous thing. And that's how it often is in our practice, especially when you look at the sense of self. We don't realize it's the sense of self trying to see the sense of self. We don't see how big of a paradigm shift it really is. So that looking, that striving. And then sometimes there's a shift. There's suddenly you see clearly. And it's the paradox is if I didn't make that effort, that shift wouldn't happen. As you all know, that it often takes that effort to learn to apply yourself for that shift to happen. These 10 pictures really teach this in a very beautiful way. This sense of using effort in a wise way and sometimes unwise way. And at some point, something shifts, and then we suddenly see the ox. We glimpse the ox. And then we go back to effort, and we go back to releasing that. And we just go back and forth. And it's a very beautiful description of this spiritual practice, this spiritual path that traces many of us as we go along. So from one side of this question of really seeing the ox or trying to solve this problem, it's impossible to figure out. Because again, that is like the hand drawing the hand. The hand can't see itself. We try so hard. It's like it's but the perspective, it's impossible to see. And then something shifts and opens up and suddenly it becomes so simple, so obvious. How could I have missed this all along? And I think many of you, if you look back in your practice, you see those shifts, like suddenly, oh, it's just this simple. It might be so simple as how do I stop judging myself for thinking? How do I actually listen a little more deeply? And then suddenly something has shifted. It could be, sometimes they're so small, we may overlook them. We may not see them. I'm encouraging us to actually notice those, to actually highlight those. To bring those to the forefront. Part of wise effort is to bring what's skillful, to maintain it, to allow it to deepen. So here, no bull can hide. So again, we're not sure what shifted, but it is something has happened. And it's often our effort. Again, those four things I mentioned of, what was the first one? Wise effort, concentration, purification, and insight. And when those moments shift, when we find ourselves in the middle of this image here of just seeing the ox, we're aware of the beauty around us. And there's a quiet, there's a stillness. We start to find ourselves relating to life, very familiar things very differently. And especially patterns that weren't so skillful, we find that suddenly our repertoire is opened up. We're not so contracted and limited in how we usually are in the world. If something has shifted and we're not quite sure what it is, it's like there's a cog in the wheel that's suddenly not there. Or maybe another analogy might be, you know, that dominoes, you know, you take dominoes and I don't know how to play the actual game of dominoes, but you like to stack them up and knock one down and they all hit each other, right? But like some of them are missing. So it goes and then it stops because there's a couple of dominoes missing. So you find yourself going down that pattern of reactivity and suddenly something ceases in you. You don't have that same impulse to go that way. Or maybe you're going up the stairs to this familiar way of judgment, of reactivity, of fear. And suddenly the stairs have gone. There's no more stairs there. And you say, well, what's changed? What's different here? This is coming into this picture here of this beauty of nature, seeing the ox, being at peace with that. So this picture really points toward that shift. that unexpected seeing the ox that's been really supported and led up by our effort before that. But it's really the release of the effort. It's this paradox. The release of the effort allows the ox to be seen. And yet if we didn't apply our effort, we wouldn't be in the position to be able to see the ox. It's such a wonderful paradox. It's kind of this joke that spirituality has for us. So it may last a few moments, it might last a few months, but often many of us find it fades after a while, unless it's so deep it's just completely takes root. But often we find it fades and so is no longer present. And this is where the next little thing comes in, the next teaching of this series, is that the state is so profound. There's such a sense of effortlessness. There's such a sense of ease. Again, it could be a very small ease, but still there's some shift. Naturally, we want more of that. Like, that's the meditation I've been doing. That's what I've been wanting all this time. I want to get more of that. Anybody have that thought ever? It's almost universal. Yeah, that was really happening there. I want to get back to that. I want to chase that state. And so often that's, you know, as a teacher, that's one of our roles, is try to point that state out. Often when I teach retreats, a common pattern people struggle with is they come in with an expectation of their past retreat. The past retreat, oh, that was so sublime. I felt I could just, I was in the middle, they didn't use this phrase, but I was in the middle of picture three. I felt just still there, right? They described that. And they want to get more of that. And they came on the retreat with an intense purpose of getting the whole retreat like that. And guess what happens? The retreat is almost opposite of that because of that expectation, that setup that they put into that. That's why often I do the opening talk, the Friday night, I say, release your expectations. Let the retreat be itself. And that's something you learn as your practice matures. You say, okay, there's these sublime states, there's these difficult states, but something else starts, you start to have more balance around. Like, okay, this is a beautiful moment, this is a more difficult moment, but you know that over time, the difficult moments sometimes teach us more than those sublime moments. We start to realize that even seeking, craving after enlightenment, craving after those peaceful states is still craving. It's still tanha. It still generates suffering. Just it's more insidious because it's built into our practice. And sometimes we get lost in just trying to get back to those states. And as soon as we're able to relax that, then suddenly the ox appears. So this is a preview for next month's picture. When we're seeing the ox, we know what it looks like, and we're struggling with it. We're trying to tame it. We're putting our whips, our ropes, and the ox escapes and disappears for a while and comes back. Does that sound at all like your practice? Yeah. Yeah. So you can start to see this. This is a very practical teaching here. You know, Rodney Smith, founder of Seattle Insight, he would often, when we talked about this issue of sometimes the more sublime or the more insightful the moment, the more we hang on to it, the more we cling to it. And he would say that, you know, a good question to ask someone in that state, because they keep talking about how wonderful that state is, try to redirect them back to, how has that state transformed you? How has that experience transformed you right here, right now? Has it changed the way you see the world? Has it changed the way you are in the world? Then you can see what's alive from that insight, how it's actually transformed the cells in your body, their very perspective. The state itself, you know, it's often based on conditions, but the transformation, the insight, that can last, that can actually start to change that. You start to see the world isn't flat. You start to see that it's actually round. So finally, the last lines. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? This is really bringing forth the wonder of this ox. This is beyond words. Because if we can see the ox and we can label it and draw it and, you know, quantify it, basically kind of fix it, in some ways it actually deadens it. When we say, like, we take a picture of somebody, it's just a snapshot of that person in that second that the camera shutter opens and closes. But it's not who they actually are. It's not what they are. Okay, so when we see, and this is what our minds like to do, is take something and fix it. Fix it in our memory, fix it in the world. And that way we encage it. And that way we deaden it to some degree. So in the midst of, when this moment arises like this, when it unfolds, there's the beauty of nature, there's the peace, there's a non-effort, and there's also the wonder of the ox that transcends words, transcends concepts. So we talked a little bit about this last time, how we only see kind of the rear of the ox. And so kind of play with this, what comes to mind around this. We can actually see the whole ox, but we just can't, we can't capture into words. It's so beyond what we can say. Our attempts to fix it, to draw it, describe it, takes us actually away, paradoxically, from the ox. This poem, I've read this many times, but it really speaks to this, by Rumi, called A Great Wagon. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. From the Sufi mystic to the Zen tradition and our own practice, you see, they all come together. The world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Even the idea of the ox, the image of the ox, it's, as soon as we've qualified it, quantified it, it's no longer its essence. And this lesson comes back in a couple more images, when the ox that we've struggled with and seeked suddenly disappears. But that'll come back in a few more months. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, and then I'll introduce the homework. And as we sit in the silence, just noticing if that ox is suddenly there. The release of effort, the release of having to do anything with this moment. The complete sufficiency. The complete perfection of this very moment. All right, before we open to any questions or sharing, and if you've done any thing around your own expression of the ox, hurting picture, this one, you're welcome to share that. But I just want to touch on the homework. So those online, I think you have it, and those here in person, they're back there. So it's really highlighting this shift of of effort. So bring attention to the times during meditation, practice, investigation, and daily life. It could be any of those times where you unexpectedly, something shifts and things become effortless, or at least less of an effort. When there's a sense of stillness, a sense of clarity. Right? So just notice when those may naturally arise. And if you start to tune to those and look for them, they might be more often than you think. They actually, and what's interesting is when you start to look for them, it almost invites them to start to come forth more and more. You start to orient to those. You start to realize, oh, just as I gaze at this other person, as I gaze at nature, it's right there. Right? Usually we're kind of biased to look at where the struggle is, where the rub is. That's where our attention goes. It's like, was it drawing on the right side of the brain where you draw, instead of drawing the object, you draw the space around the object. That's all I know from that book. But but it's kind of, it's a little bit of that shift. It's like, oh, there's a thing that I'm kind of obsessed about, but there's also all this other stuff. And you start to realize that as you connect with it, what's not charged, and that sense of effortless, it changes something inside of you. You start to recognize that's actually resonates with something that seems very central to what I am. It doesn't make sense. I can't quite define it, but there's something about that. I can't put words to it, but there's something that seems to resonate, something deep about who and what I am. In contrast to that, notice when you get reactive to something, there's a different quality. Like, okay, I'm definitely me and you. I'm getting ready for a fight around it. I'm really reactive, or I'm fearful of it, whatever it might be. Just to start to highlight that, to notice that. And because that state is, it does feel, even in the moment, you can resonate with that sense of stillness, that sense of ease, and that sense of being profound, there can be a tendency to chase them, to grasp after them. And notice how you grasp after them, that is almost guaranteed to make them disappear. Okay, so you start to play with that. It's like, oh, that's really nice. I want more of that. And suddenly it's vanished. And where did it go? Literally, these pictures talk about the ox is suddenly gone. Next month, we see that. Instead, practice surrendering into it. Just see, what happens if I just relax into that, like surrendering into a warm bath? And then when or if they pass, how have they transformed you and the world? How they transformed how you perceive the world, how you are in the world? So we won't have a chance to do any discussion on that next week. I'm going to be actually teaching again just for that first Monday, because Tweri is teaching a retreat, and we'll go into the next picture. But I wanted to give you this homework to play with, to work with. All right, so we have a chance now for any sharing or questions you might have. So let's see, for those online, you can raise your virtual hand, probably best. And then here in person, you could raise your physical hand. Okay, Carlito.
Hi, Tim. Would you say there's a connection between the experience of life review and purification? Is that kind of two sides of the same coin, or are they connected in some way?
Can you say the two that you're comparing, life view and what was the other one?
Yeah, so the life reviews, you know, that experience that can happen, and then also the purification process. Are those connected? Or I'm just curious about that.
Sure, I certainly connected them in my talk as a form of purification that you know, sometimes again, at the end of our life, naturally we kind of want a clean house, as it were, clean mental health, house, physical house, emotional house, and really try to be good with as many people as we can. And so that the impetus of our own mortality brings the energy to that. Meditation itself can just start to do that by just by the process of, like, it's almost like we're saying, you're sitting down and say, okay, tell me about yourself. Tell me what's going on. And then, you know, your heart starts to show things, your mind starts to show things, your body starts to show things. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to meet that in a way that doesn't contract it back up, that we're able to meet in a skillful way that doesn't get too overwhelming, then it starts to purify through us. And sometimes, you know, we can have things which are so charged that we need to learn how to work with them more skillfully, so we don't, you know, re-traumatize ourselves, for example, or, you know, kind of reinforce things. Because it's, you know, ideally it should be a gentle process. A little bit like I talked about 2 weeks ago, having that quality of a broad attention. So I might be, you know, focusing on, like, this iPad. Let's say this is this deeper pain that I haven't felt for a while, just suddenly presenting itself. If I'm able to sense that, but also be aware of all the people in the room, feel the breeze against my skin, see the sense of light, suddenly I'm meeting it with a much more balanced way. But when I kind of lock into it, that's all I'm seeing, then it's more likely to kind of double down or get reinforced. Does that make sense?
It does. That's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Anyone here in the room? All right. What about back online? The questions and comments, you know, they really help flesh out the talk, help us explore from different angles. So I know it's kind of intimidating to speak out, but it's a safe place. It's hopefully as safe as you can make it. Okay, Emery.
Hi there. I found this talk to be just kind of validating and motivating, because it is really easy to focus on the struggle and focus on the effort and the challenges of practice, you know, and the ways that practice might not be going as well or as quickly as I hope, or the ways that practice doesn't seem to be infiltrating other aspects of my life. As you talk today, I realized that, you know, there are small and even maybe medium ways where the ox, like, I do see the ox, like, it's kind of like that picture, just kind of lurking around, like halfway in the, you know, behind a tree or in the brambles, but there. And it's just really nice to have that kind of called out and pointed out. And in my practice lately too, I have been sort of able, like, I've been really aware of how much I try to control how things are and how they turn out, and so I'll be able to sometimes just, like, almost with a sense of exasperation, like, okay, I'm just gonna stop for a minute and see what's here when I stop trying to control it or trying to make a certain outcome. And it, you know, it is a little bit magical, like, oh, there's like a whole reality, a whole universe of that exists when, even without me having to do anything, it just is. And then usually I snap back into, you know, dissatisfaction somewhat quickly, but I feel like this talk has made me feel like it's important to reside in that space of just like abiding with all of it, with all of the confusion, with all of the chaos, with all of the imperfections. So, and that's the ox, even if it looks kind of messy from the inside or the outside. So thank you. This was just really, I feel affirmed and inspired by what you've talked about tonight.
Good. Thank you for sharing that, Emery. Yeah, you articulated that really well, how we tend to really focus and obsess around what's wrong or where the difficulty is. I mean, we really are, our DNA is really designed to do that. It's really built into us. And so, you start to see, but you're seeing more and more, as you said, these times when you see the ox in small ways and medium ways, probably even more big ways than you may realize. And those start to add up. And what starts to happen is at some point you start to shift where you really truly think you are, what really truly is, who makes up you as a person. A sense of identity. Because, usually our practice, before our practice, our identity is really oriented toward the struggle. We feel the most like ourselves when we're feeling really bad about ourselves. When we're really upset, we really feel ourselves. When we're really, or also when we're really excited about something too, that we also may feel really like ourselves, but then, we're struggling to get back to that. And, it's like we really feel that's who I am. That's our orientation is that's me. Now that's really in contrast to those moments, like as you're saying, seeing the ox, when you just say, okay, I'm going to just release this, trying to figure this out. And suddenly something else just kind of rises to the forefront. And which is more primary? Is it the struggle or is it what rises up when you cease struggling? And just start to maybe float that question. And when each of those states, that simple duality is noticing, where do I take myself to, who really am I? Am I this one or am I this one? And one is going to be much easier to define and you can write a book about it. And one of them you may not be able to say anything about. So just play with that and start to say, okay, where do I really reside? All right, thank you for sharing that, Emery. All right, anyone else like to share anything? Okay, anyone here in room? Yes, come on up. Do you mind using the mic? I'm going to switch so we can see online here. All right, go ahead.
I just wanted to echo what the other Sangha member talked about in their gratitude for the talk. And I received it as a profound message of hope. And I know in the Dharma practice, we don't always associate the word hope with the practice, seeing things as they truly are. But I felt hopeful that the ox can appear when you least expect it. And one quick anecdote from my own experience was catching a red-eye flight. I didn't want to catch the flight, and it was a terrible experience, but my practice of the Dharma kind of opened my heart to looking for a silver lining in the experience and just being with the suffering of being afraid of flying and then knowing I'm not going to see from the flight. And because of that, I looked to my left and I saw an aurora borealis.
Boom.
This was late last year.
Hey.
And I was waking people out of their sleep. Look, this is an aurora borealis. And so if I hadn't have got on that red eye and kind of embraced all that comes with that, that pressure, that suffering. I would have never seen the Aurora Borealis. And I didn't know people hadn't seen it before. I tell people, like, you saw one? I want to go there to see one. So that was a version of the ox.
That's right.
And I carry that story, my own story, with me. It makes me profoundly hopeful in the moments of despair. And I think that, I think Buddhism does offer something in the way of hopefulness for a world that often is deep in despair. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing that. Go back here and there. So yeah, just a couple reflections on what you shared. Yes, so that a sense of expectation that we often have, like, you know, being afraid of flight and what, you know, what might happen, and how, you know, we really paint this projection of how the world will look. Sometimes it's based on our experience, and, you know, and there's a discernment to that, but it's also, a lot of it is just is that way that our minds really imprison ourselves. And I think Buddhist practice is very hopeful, because it's like it does show you the potential for releasing that and opening to the wonder of the moment. And, you know, like on that flight, you saw something that, again, most people don't see, you know, this beautiful experience of nature through that. And, you know, that's such a beautiful lesson to have, that quality of, it's an open-mindedness, but it's also that buoyancy of hope. And, you know, as our practice, you know, the more times we do that, we start to become more hopeful. We start to have confidence in ourselves. There's like a sense of, like Sharon Salzberg wrote a book on faith, and how there's kind of this blind faith when we first practice, like, well, that sounds good, I want to try that. And we start to get enthusiastic. And then at some point it becomes confirmed faith, actually see through our own experience. And that perhaps is a form of hope, is that, you know, I'm not sure what the future holds, but I have more and more faith or confidence or hope that I'll be able to meet that. And it may actually open, you know, that ox may reveal itself in more and more ways. So thank you for sharing that. All right. So Judith, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have a poem as usual. And this poem popped into my mind right after I first saw this picture. And I said, I couldn't see why. I couldn't really see the connection. And it's that it persisted throughout the month. And so I kind of have begun to see connections. Maybe you'll see some, I don't know. But anyway, I'll share it. This is a poem that I wrote. It's in my pre-haiku days. And I wrote it back when I was living in Quebec, 2 weeks before 9/11. I was living in the country by myself, and it was 10 o'clock at night, and there was something disturbing in the air, not in my own personal life, but it's just something I felt, almost like, you know, Star Wars, a disturbance in the force, that kind of thing. And it drove me out of the house. And I went down and I sat in the garden for a while. And then when I came back, I wrote this poem. The Night Garden, August 28th, 2001. In the hush of the night garden, I look deep into the well of tears. I find reflected the crescent moon and the smoldering gaze of the red-eyed planet. The field beyond the garden is dark and still. I hear crickets and the surprise of a deer who has discovered my presence. I stand on a rock and survey the night. Like Adam, I speak the names of things. Dark field, singing crickets, startled deer, red planet, shining moon. I pause, and my words fall into the darkness. There are not tears enough for the world in all its broken beauty. I sit on the rock and close my eyes. The moonlight shines in my mind, and I return sorrowing to you, giver and taker of all there is. This is your night, one dark blossom from from the Garden of Nights. I cannot ask for more.
Thank you, Judith. That's very profound. All right, Alma.
I'm putting off my video in the hope that the sound will be better. That was beautiful, Judith. I also wrote a poem, a short haiku, based on an experience I had several days ago, where I was sitting quietly in my living room with the patio door ajar. And I'll read the poem. Movement in stillness. A hummingbird shimmers by my patio door. Movement in stillness. A hummingbird shimmers by my patio door. And the thing about it was that it was a really, there was an immediacy about the moment. And it was very clear. It was a pristine experience. And my heart was really engaged. It lifted as I saw this, and I felt separation, a sense of separation between myself and the hummingbird disappear. And it was just in a, it was so brief, it flew away. And I've had a number of experiences like that, but this was the most recent one, and I don't usually write about them. So.
Great. Thank you so much, Alma. Yeah, that's just seeing the ox. And seeing the ox and seeing that reflection in the inner stillness. So thank you for sharing that. All right, anyone else like to share anything before we close? All right, come on up, Cheryl.
While you were talking, Tim, I realized today I was struggling with something, and I don't want to go into it too much, but I was struggling kind of deeply with something, and as you were talking, I saw the ox. It was right there. And it was like, oh, it's just this. And all that struggle really just kind of faded away. But it was, you know, it's a seeing the ox. I realized in that moment that it's a momentary thing, that I can see the ox in a moment. And, you know, and it's just, didn't really answer a question, but it was almost like a relief. You know, there was a relief. Something was solved. Something was like a. And so it was, and in that moment, it was like I saw the ox, and that's how it felt. So thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, it's just, you start to realize that it's just a moment away. It's just a shift is actually always here, you know, and the ox, you know, we're not actually seeing an ox, but we're seeing what the ox represents. You know, I was thinking, someone was listening and like, I can't see the ox. But we all know what you mean, you know, just that, you know, you see that it's not falling away. And there's often that, yeah, there is that sense of something you were struggling with. Suddenly there's that peace there. So the challenge I would give each one of us is to see, you know, how far away is that ox really? How buried is it? Or how available might it be? You know, what is the shift that is right there? Is right, is all it takes is just this, something is released. Right? And then the practice, you start to say, okay, whatever is arising in my life, even in that midst of that, can I still let that ox present itself?